When we enter today's story, darkness has fallen, and the sound of the river Jabbok mocks Jacob at his back. Jacob's tactics have failed him. 400 men are riding in his direction, most likely to kill him. He's exhausted and he's scared. And it's at this moment, this dark, vulnerable, and pregnant moment, that a figure emerges from the shadows and leaps upon him. But first, there is more to the story. Jacob has bargained and connived his way through his entire life. To be fair, he had a great teacher in his mother, Rebekah. But in his adulthood, Jacob has made an art of subterfuge. He has tricked and beguiled his father and his uncle, and most dangerously, he has cheated his older brother, Esau, who we are led to believe is a strong, impulsive, and potentially violent man. After that incident, Jacob, so worried about his brother's wrath, that he fled his homeland and stayed away for 20 years. But he now finds himself compelled to return, and he is afraid. Jacob has for so long lived his life in a way that puts him at the center, that he doesn't know how to live differently. What's more, because Jacob has been so careful and clever about all his deceptions, to the outside world, his way of living appears respectable and certainly prosperous. He's surrounded by the fruit of his labors, family, wealth, material abundance, and the admiration of all those around him. In our day and age, he would have a fine home, a boilerplate car, memberships at all the right clubs and places, and just enough charitable contributions that people would talk about his benevolence over lunch. It would never be spoken, at least not in polite conversation, of the tactics that he has used to build this life, or the people that he has sullied and harmed along the way. As Jacob has moved ever closer to home and to his brother Esau, he's taken the bull by the horns and he's dealt with this situation in the only way that he knows how. He's attempted to buy his brother off. He has sent in front of him to Esau wave after wave of appeasement, servants and camels and riches as gifts to shield himself from Esau's condemnation. It is a plan that would have worked in any other prior instance in his life. But as this day wanes, and the sounds of the river Jabbok mock him at his back, Jacob realizes that his plan is as bankrupt as he now finds himself to be. Esau and those 400 men, they're still coming. Jacob's things have left him. The layers, material and otherwise, that he has so long believed protect him from all threats are gone. Darkness is falling, and Jacob feels naked and exposed. We know that feeling, don't we? We, like Jacob, labor to build a life around us that reflects our value in the eyes of others. We attempt to gather layers of wealth and material abundance and social regard, most especially social regard, around ourselves to shield us from the critique of a hostile world, whether that world is hostile towards us because that's its nature, or whether, as in Jacob's case, it's hostile because we have so often used and abused it to our own advantage. Sometimes we build up these layers mostly to shield us from ourselves, to trick ourselves into believing that the accumulation of our lives has been pristinely attained, that we have acted in ways that would make ourselves or our communities or our God take joy. The more gilded and abundant our lives, the less likely anyone, including ourselves, will notice the ways in which we have acted uncharitably, with deception. and with ourselves and our place in the world always at the center. But then occasionally, darkness falls. The world becomes quiet, and we change out of all those layers of our daytime lives and into the thinner fabric of the night. Our defensive walls fall. The ruse is no longer convincing. We feel naked and exposed, and we are afraid. It is at this moment that Jacob is leapt upon from the darkness. He has no servant to guard his back. He has no money to pay off this mugger. He has no time to come up with some convoluted scheme. He has only those two visceral options, fight or flight. And somehow, some way, by God's grace, surely, Jacob responds in this moment of panic in a way counter to the manner that he has lived his entire life up until this point. He grabs hold of his attacker, and he will not let go. He holds so tightly that he can feel the other's heartbeat as closely as he feels his own. Now, Jacob is no fool. He recognizes that wrestling with this figure from the darkness could scar him for life, as indeed it does when the attacker strikes Jacob's hip. But he also senses that somehow his life is to be found in the struggle. No longer can he hide behind his things. No longer can he resort to subterfuge. Now there is only this honest, life-depending, life-giving embrace. "Bless me," Jacob cries to the man, and the response he receives is stunning. "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel," says his combatant, "because you have striven with God," which is what Israel means, by the way, "and you have prevailed." Jacob's assessment of what has occurred is the clearest insight he has ever or will ever have. "I have seen God face to face," he says, "and my life is preserved." And with that, the figure's gone. Day breaks, a day like no other, and Jacob stands and faces the way in which his brother lies. He sets out without pause, and we are told that he limps, then and ever after. It is the most important lesson, and it is one that our daytime lives would rather not consider. We cannot know God so long as we stay hidden and protected behind the layers and the walls of our lives, defining ourselves by them, and willfully forgetting all those things that we have done to accumulate them. It is when, like Jacob, we find ourselves bereft of these pretend defenses that we finally experience the vulnerability necessary to know God. And then we must be prepared that God may leap upon us with the rough and tumble of a wrestler rather than meeting us with the gentleness of an outstretched hand. God may seek to grab us and to jar us into a realization that our old way of being will no longer suffice. And we have two options. We can run away as fast and furiously as our legs will carry us, or we can latch hold of God as Jacob did, so that our hearts are pulled so close to His that we begin to feel the synchronicity of their beating. In that moment, we can understand that this is what it means to be in relationship with God, to struggle, to be challenged, to render ourselves vulnerable to journeys that God would have us take, and to the rivers that He would have us cross. And like Jacob, We may get scars, but they are always akin to the scar one receives after something like open heart surgery. They're the kind of scars that forever remain, but that remind us through this struggle we find new life. We find purpose. We find the strength of a companion whose heart will beat as our own so long as we seek his embrace. This is the great moment of Jacob's life. I wish that his Genesis story ended here, but it doesn't. Very soon, Jacob meets his brother Esau, and instead of condemnation, he receives grace. The Genesis narrator tells us that in Esau, Jacob sees the face of God. Esau, who represents now in the story the same God with whom Jacob so recently wrestled, wishes Jacob nothing but good. He invites Jacob to stay with him, to live as one family in love, in joy, and in mutual strength. And we who have just heard the story of the river Jabbok are ready for Jacob's reply. Yes, he'll surely say, I'm now ready to live with God, to respond to him, even though it may be a struggle, to define my life by him and no other. But that's not what Jacob says. Doubt creeps back in. The lure of that old life beckons. And Jacob turns away from Esau, from the very face of God. He reclaims all those things that he has earlier shed, and he walks another way. And in next week's reading, as you'll see, Jacob has receded from the scene. He's mentioned a few times again, but the main character in the Genesis story shifts to Joseph, his son. In other words, Holy Scripture leaves us with this tantalizing dual image of Jacob. On the one hand, we have the Jacob who comes to understand the full implications of his relationship with God that is neither occasional nor convenient. We have the Jacob who welcomes the struggle with God in his life and draws his heart close to God's own. And on the other hand, we have the Jacob who can't stand to remain in the gaze of God. We have the Jacob who falters when Esau, the God figure, rebuffs his every effort to buy his forgiveness and love and asks only that Jacob remain in his presence. The Jacob who only hours before held God heart to heart now can't even bear to walk with him side by side. Jacob makes every excuse to walk away. And he takes his family and his belongings, and he moves in the direction opposite God. Scripture leaves us with no tidy ending to this story, because neither our lives nor our walk with God are ever tidy. What Scripture leaves with us are two options, both found in this one patriarch of our faith. In the vulnerable moments of our lives, no matter how dark they may seem, God will be present. He seeks us out to wrestle with us, challenging us to keep nothing between his heart and ours. God is there. We can run away, or we can grab hold. And when we accept God's holy embrace, and when we cling to it with all our might, we may find that we say with Jacob, who becomes Israel,